But if technological civilizations are more common, then we must resolve the Fermi paradox in a different way. We know that any solution is really a reflection in the mirror of universality, an interpretation of humanity's future based on what one believes about the present. With this understanding, and with many speculations about the laws of Bitcoin astronomy and alien blockchains behind us, we propose a new solution to the Fermi paradox, a member of the They're Waiting for Our Signal family. We haven't detected alien civilizations because we only just built Bitcoin.
The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible.
What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are diving back into Bitcoin Astronomy by Dhruv Bansal. Sorry for the long weekend and not getting out part two. It was seriously a busy weekend and recording just was not in the cards. But we are back and we have the conclusion of Bitcoin Astronomy, the third law. So we're going to dive right in today. If you haven't listened to the first half from yesterday's episode, well, this is going to make absolutely no sense at all. And if you haven't listened to the first and second law of Dhruv's Bitcoin Astronomy series, well, then I'm sorry, you're just missing out on some real digital gold. You may or may not find links to them in the show notes. I don't know. I can't say for sure, but you'll just have to go see. But before we dive in, let's extend some gratitude to the light givers and coffee funders in the Bitcoin Audible studio. And that will start with longtime supporter, Bitcoin-only Pure Signal Swan Bitcoin. Set up your recurring savings plan, and then join me and the insane group of Bitcoiners at the epic Pacific Bitcoin Conference in November. 20% off your tickets with code GUYS. And then to travel, you want to spend with the Fold card. If you use fiat at all, you know the Fold card. It is a sats giving fiat debit card. It just always gives you sats. You can spend for more sats, and you can get sats on the daily wheel, and you get sats for gift cards to your favorite merchants and sats in the metaverse sats game. So if you like sats, I don't know, maybe check out Fold. And then when you auto buy on Swan, when you come to the Pacific Bitcoin Conference, and you get your sats back on your Fold card, you're going to keep all that crap safe with your cold card. Or honestly, any of the multitude of incredible Bitcoin security and hardware tools at CoinKite.com. You will get links to all of these somewhere extremely close by. Where could that be? I think it rhymes with no-shows. All right, with that, let's get into today's read. The conclusion of Bitcoin Astronomy Part 3, The Third Law, beginning on the section titled Communicating is Computing. Nakamotans don't just send us Xenocoin because they're greedy. Sending Xenocoin is a good idea because the optimal way to transmit a cross-species message may be to first transmit a computer. Let's use the example of data compression to illustrate this idea. A common way to reduce the transmission costs of messages is to compress all data being sent. The trade-off is that receivers must decompress the data. This requires receivers to have a computer program that understands how the compression was originally performed in order to undo it. We decompress data all the time behind the scenes on our human internet. But if an alien civilization wanted to send us a large amount of compressed data, how could they ensure we have the appropriate decompression algorithm? Zip is barely a standard on Earth, much less the galaxy. They might rely upon us to reverse engineer the compression algorithm, but an easier method would be to transmit the decompression program itself alongside the compressed data. But this just introduces another difficulty. How do we run this decompression program? We can't possibly load it into our laptops. The ultimate solution is to transmit the computer itself. Extraterrestrial senders can include in their messages an uncompressed specification of the rules for a virtual machine. Virtual machines of quite simple designs can perform arbitrarily complex computations, given the right input. Receivers would use their own hardware and software to implement this virtual machine and then feed it the rest of the compressed message as input data. The result would, hopefully, be a decompressed message. Computer experts should be feeling a mix of eagerness and horror at this point. From the programmer's perspective, designing programs for aliens to run is awesome, and people already love to do it. But from a security engineer's perspective, this sounds like aliens asking us to install and run Java from an untrusted source. There are good reasons for concern. The insolubility of the halting problem means that the only sure way to know what a computer program does is to let it run until it consumes all its resources or decides to stop. What if the virtual machine we receive is a malicious AI? Some researchers believe that complex messages would need to be destroyed in the risk-averse case, because they cannot be decontaminated with certainty, and can pose an existential threat. Thankfully, not every virtual machine needs to be Turing complete. We can solve the halting problem for virtual machines with sufficient limitations. We can prove such machines consume a bounded amount of resources and only run fixed algorithms, such as decompression. This helps receivers trust virtual machines even though they cannot fathom their alien creators. Blockchains are shelling points. But compression is just one simple example of the more general idea that limited virtual machines are a good way to communicate between species. Blockchain interpreters are limited virtual machines. This is another reason why Nakamotans will send us Xenocoin. If a message contains an arbitrary virtual machine, say one for decompressing data, as in our example above, we are still left with the question of how to interpret its output. Even if we could find a way to structure this output as symbolic, audio, and/or visual information, how could we interpret that? This is ultimately a problem of semiotics. To communicate in natural language, senders and receivers must share signs, combinations of signifiers, symbols, sounds, images, gestures, and things signified, ideas and concepts such as "we come in peace" or "here is how to build a warp drive." The difficulty of this problem shouldn't be underestimated. The film Arrival spends much of its airtime on the characters learning how to interpret alien signs. One way to reduce the difficulty of the semiotic problem is to restrict the universe of discourse. Instead of being able to signify any possible thing, if signs were assumed to be about a fixed number of classes of things signified, then they would be easier to interpret. But the Nakamotans can't tell us in advance how to limit our universe of discourse because we can't communicate. That's the problem we're solving. Somehow, species must converge on the same universe of discourse without prior communication. There must exist a natural shelling point for how to limit the shape and subject of an initial interstellar conversation. We've discussed above that virtual machines are a natural way to communicate across space, and so they form the structural half of this shelling point. Messages are programs. But species must also converge on the semantic half of the shelling point. What does the program do? The third law provides the answer. If all species use blockchains, then blockchains are a shelling point for the semantics of interstellar programs. The Nakamotans will send us the Xenocoin blockchain because they will assume that we will interpret any message we receive as a blockchain, because that's what they would do. Reaching this shelling point accomplishes three simultaneous objectives. First, blockchain interpreters are limited by design. Bitcoin's script is designed to halt on all inputs and consume a bounded amount of resources. Assuming first contact messages are blockchains decreases the risk senders ask receivers to take when implementing virtual machines to interpret their messages. Second, reducing the universe of discourse to the paucity of concepts required to implement a blockchain greatly reduces the semiotic problem. While an interstellar blockchain such as Xenocoin is vastly greater in scale and hash rate than Bitcoin, it operates on the same principles. If some signifier seems to play the role of a public key, then senders can confidently assume that the thing signified is the public key itself. Blockchain interpreters, such as Bitcoin's script, do contain complex cryptographic algorithms, such as SHA-256 hashing or ECDSA signing, as primitive opcodes. These algorithms aren't likely to be universal across civilizations or blockchains, but if senders are actually including a virtual machine for a blockchain interpreter, they can also include implementations of its cryptographic opcodes. This is similar to how the core Bitcoin software distribution includes custom cryptographic routines alongside its virtual machine. Finally, and most importantly, blockchain transactions are inherently opaque to all but their participants. They contain no semantic content. This relieves receivers from needing to interpret what they mean. We just need to ensure they validate. If a message includes both blockchain interpreter and blockchain data, then the two can be used to cross-validate each other, aiding in interpretation. The ultimate proof that receivers correctly understand the message is when they validate for themselves that the Xenocoin blockchain meets the consensus rules of Xenocoin. The medium is the message. But a blockchain isn't just proof of successful transmission. It's a self-validating history of a civilization's economic activity. Just as ancient Sumerian clay tablets help us understand the Sumerian civilization, a blockchain helps us understand the civilization transmitting it. Nakamotans will send us Xenocoin because they want us to grok them. A blockchain's block time tells the receiver something about the physical scale of the sender's civilization. Block times of minutes for planetary blockchains, weeks for stellar, and centuries for interstellar blockchains such as Xenocoin. The long time scale of Xenocoin is an open invitation. It means Xenocoin's hash horizon is correspondingly large, big enough to include us, should we choose to join it. A blockchain's length, in combination with its block time, tells the receiver about the age and economic history of the sender's civilization. Are they a young Type 1 civilization with a stellar blockchain experiencing early monetization? Or an advanced Type 2 civilization, such as the Nakamotans, with a mature interstellar blockchain such as Xenocoin? As we measure the velocity of distant stars through their Doppler shifts, we will measure the velocity of distant monies through their Holder waves. A blockchain's weight, the proof of work done to construct it, tells the receiver about the economy of the sender's civilization. Though the same virtual machine algorithm will require different amounts of real energy in different civilizations because of their different levels of computing technologies, a civilization can still estimate what it would cost them in compute and energy to mine the blocks they see in another civilization's blockchain. Any strong, repeating, narrow-band artificial signal the Nakamotans send us would be a techno-signature, proof to us of an alien civilization. But a blockchain is a very special kind of self-validating, self-signifying techno-signature. It cannot be faked, except at astronomical expense, and it comes with its own built-in interpretation. A blockchain is a thermodynamically signed, cryptographic proof of a civilization's position on the Kardashev scale. Sending us Xenocoin is a way for the Nakamotans to flex on us. Blockchain as lingua franca. First contact is as much a meeting of markets as it is tribes or species. Commerce is one of the chief drivers of exploration that causes distant tribes to meet in the first place, and the history of commerce is full of lingua francas, specialized jargons which develop to facilitate trade between tribes that speak different languages. A conversation between humanity and the Nakamotans taking place over light years with the goal of coming to mutual understanding, knowledge, and prosperity could take millennia.
Xenocoin serves as a lingua franca during this time. It maintains the conversation until both sides develop a better shared language, one capable of a more meaningful exchange of ideas than transactions and blocks. If we're lucky, the Nakamotans will be willing to invest in learning how to have more meaningful conversations with us. But the Nakamotans could be jaded or disinterested. Perhaps they are used to promising young civilizations that nonetheless collapse, never to be heard from again. They're willing to send us Xenocoin, but they may not choose to make any further investments in learning our language until we prove ourselves worthy. First contact. Let us assume that one day humanity detects a strong, repeating, narrow-band signal from an unknown Nakamotan entity. The signal is long and complex, and is found to contain certain amounts of binary encoded data. This message is subsequently found to contain the Xenocoin blockchain and virtual machine specifications. How will our species react? Blockchain uplifting. The third law asserts that all technological civilizations will develop Bitcoin, but it doesn't preclude that some civilizations might learn about it from others. So let's first consider a counterfactual scenario. What if humanity were to receive this signal before Satoshi Nakamoto invented Bitcoin? Could we have deciphered it? Obviously, if it were hundreds of years ago, we would neither have detected it nor have been able to understand it. But let's assume the signal was received in 2005, years before Bitcoin, but at a point in human history where encryption was already widely deployed on the internet and cypherpunks had already experimented with projects such as Hashcash, B-Money, and BitGold. Satoshi described Bitcoin in English and familiar mathematics and implemented it using common programming languages, yet it is still difficult for most humans to understand how Bitcoin works. Many don't even try. An alien blockchain might have been inscrutable. But wouldn't that only have made it more fascinating? Huge resources would have been spent by governments, universities, and corporations to, quote, crack the signal. Despite lacking an example blockchain of our own, assume that we are able to understand that we're dealing with a virtual machine which does cryptography on a data set. Someone, perhaps Satoshi, would eventually have made the connection between proof of work, cryptographic money, and distributed ledgers. The only hypothetical origin story for Bitcoin more incredible than its real history would be that it was inspired by alien money from the stars. Whether this origin would have hastened or slowed Bitcoin's creation or adoption is anyone's guess. Resistance is futile. Thankfully, humanity already knows about Bitcoin. So when we learn about Xenocoin, we will be able to decipher it more quickly than if we had to figure out blockchains themselves first. We will quickly perceive the scale, age, and power of the Nakamotan civilization. These numbers are likely to be so large that they frighten us. Entities with access to hash rate on such tremendous scales pose serious threats to human civilization. What if they coordinated to send a hash bomb, destroying Bitcoin, Muskcoin, Solcoin, or another human blockchain? What if they spent a similar amount of energy on real weapons? Some elements of human society may despair or turn inward, believing the universe to be under a Pax Nakamota that provincial savages like ourselves should better avoid. Others may urge faster industrialization and greater investment in our own blockchains. Perhaps proof that a blockchain on the scale of Xenocoin can exist is what finally causes Solcoin to take off in our solar system, a mad idea suddenly proven right. Others will realize that Xenocoin is an opportunity. Humanity may not yet have launched an interstellar blockchain of our own, and if we were to do so, it would have to compete against Xenocoin. Xenocoin's far greater hash rate is likely to win. The endgame is clear. If we can't compete with the Nakamotans, then we must join them. Running Xenocoin. All we have to do to join the Xenocoin network is send Xenocoin back to the Nakamoden source we received it from. This tells the Nakamodens we are receiving their messages and that we have a transmitter. It also shows them we're not going to noise up the channel with useless hello or what is the secret of life messages. It lets them know we're ready to participate more fully in their peer-to-peer network, in the Xenocoin blockchain. Once they receive our response, the Nakamoden response might be to test us, sending us the occasional invalid Xenocoin transaction or block. If we blithely transmit these back, they'll know we don't yet understand the protocol. We might risk being put on a cosmic ban list for a few centuries. But if, for many Xenocoin blocks, we consistently transmit back all valid transactions the Nakamoden send us, then they may begin to invest more resources in our relationship. Perhaps they would begin transmitting more frequently, continuously, instead of periodically. We would respond in kind, committing more of our own energy budget towards maintaining this vital interstellar communications link. At some point, our Nakamoden peer would send us, or we might learn how to ask for ourselves, information about other Xenocoin peers. We would send signals to them as well, hopefully receiving back responses decades later. Each new peer we successfully connect to would lead us to discover its peers. We may realize that our galactic neighborhood is full of Xenocoin-using star systems, all willing to peer with us since we now share the same economic language. Our civilization would have become a full node in the Xenocoin blockchain. Using Xenocoin. It may take us centuries to become a well-connected Xenocoin node and to establish real communication with Nakamoden civilization. As we do, we are likely to have many questions we'd like the Nakamodens to answer. Nakamodens may be open with us and answer our questions freely. They may be eager to communicate and willing to uplift our civilization. But they may also be reticent to interact with us, wary of exposing us to knowledge or technology we aren't ready for, perhaps with historical reasons for why they feel this way. But the Nakamodens aren't a single entity. They're a heterogeneous civilization like us. They won't act with complete uniformity, and we needn't rely upon their generosity. If we possessed Xenocoin, we could purchase what we wanted from willing Nakamoden individuals, companies, or distributed exchanges. There are significant incentives for humanity to acquire Xenocoin. Factions of our civilization which do so first will wield significant power. They might be able to buy scientific breakthroughs or blueprints for advanced technologies. They might purchase training from Nakamoden educators for their engineers to build these technologies, or from Nakamoden defense contractors for their soldiers to wield them. For obscene amounts of Xenocoin, they might be able to pay real Nakamoden adventurers to travel to human settlements so that we may meet and study them, or worship them for some. Or they might just get scammed by a Nakamoden fake Toshi. Given the incentives to accumulate Xenocoin, the incentives to steal it will also be high. Custodying Xenocoin, the most valuable currency in the galaxy, will be too important to be left to any one individual or even any one world. Collaborative multi-sig custody on the cosmic scale, spread across planets and star systems, will be the only way to hold Xenocoin. Mining Xenocoin. But before we can spend or custody Xenocoin, we must possess some. How will humanity earn Xenocoin in the first place? If Nakamodens are curious about us, they might value information about our civilization and species. We might be savvy and view information about ourselves as the one asset we possess in greater abundance than an advanced civilization such as the Nakamodens. A small bubble of human history data speculation might tickle Nakamoden markets for a few thousand years. But eventually, the entire human internet will be pirated and sold to the lowest Xenocoin bidder, and no matter how curious Nakamodens might have been about us, we'll have little else to trade them that they don't already know. Nakamodens might be interested in acquiring human currencies. We might not have an interstellar blockchain that can compete with Xenocoin, But Soulcoin or other human blockchains may be collectibles for Nakamoto's elite or institutions. Some Nakamoto's investors might desire Bitcoin just because of the memes. If Xenocoin supports cross-chain atomic swaps, then Nakamoto and human traders can trustlessly exchange Xenocoin and Bitcoin, Soulcoin, or other tokens of any other human blockchains. Eventually, as trade between our civilizations increases, exchange rates will emerge between human currencies and Xenocoin. These rates are interstellar valuations of the relative markets and prospects for Xenocoin and human blockchains. The best way for humanity to earn Xenocoin, long-term, is for us to mine it. The crucible of human civilization is likely to be many light-years away from the Xenocoin center of hash near the Nakamoto homeworlds. But Xenocoin has a block time of centuries, specifically so that civilizations like ours, many light-years from the center of hash, can still mine. Nakamotans want us to mine Xenocoin because they want Xenocoin to grow. They might also be waiting for us to mine Xenocoin. The ability to do so indicates our civilization is worth investing further resources in. But given the huge hash rate of Xenocoin, mining any for ourselves will require joining a distributed Xenocoin mining pool. Nakamotans themselves likely use such pools to mine Xenocoin across the various star systems of their civilization. We could even join in pools with other Xenocoin-using star systems. Perhaps there exists a Xenocoin mining pool favored by young civilizations such as ourselves, spread far and wide in between the pockets of much larger civilizations that make up the Nakamotan sphere. Depending on the gap between humanity and the Nakamotans on the Kardashev scale, we may need to allocate a significant fraction of our hash rate over millennia if we're ever to earn a meaningful amount of Xenocoin from our mining pool. Initially, few people will be willing to mine Xenocoin over Soulcoin, Bitcoin, or some other human blockchain. A hyper-Bitcoinized society's energy and mining industries are deeply intertwined and both extremely efficient. In contrast, early human Xenocoin mining technology will be primitive and inefficient, preventing it from being rapidly adopted by the mining industry at scale. But over time, humans will develop Xenocoin ASICs to make our miners more competitive in the broader Xenocoin hash rate market. And as we learn more about the Nakamotan civilization and what we can purchase with Xenocoin, our desire to possess it will increase. The combination will lead to gradual adoption of Xenocoin mining across human civilization. The long timescales of Xenocoin blocks means that few miners will dedicate 100% of their hash rate to Xenocoin. As discussed in Part 2, the Bitcoin and Soulcoin markets will continue to exist and thrive. Miners will apportion some fraction of their hash rate to planetary, stellar, and interstellar blockchains as they see fit. We may not have created Xenocoin, but Xenocoin may nonetheless become our civilization's interstellar blockchain. Even if we can't communicate with the Nakamotans, we can still use Xenocoin within human civilization. As an interstellar blockchain with a huge hash rate, Xenocoin is already suitable for optimizing human interstellar trade networks and allowing humans to store value and manage risk across the longest timescales. It's possible that the Nakamotan civilization is full of species that don't communicate or trade greatly with each other, but all use Xenocoin as their interstellar blockchain. It is in this sense what we meant earlier when we said that Xenocoin really is the Nakamotan civilization. By adopting and mining Xenocoin, we ourselves become Nakamotans. We become a Type 2 civilization. Returning to the Fermi Paradox. Let's return to the Fermi Paradox, the tension between the size and age of the galaxy and the scant evidence of technological civilizations within it. All our preceding speculations are compatible with a galaxy in which technological civilizations are extremely rare. If ours is the first technological civilization in the galaxy, then we might be the future creators of Xenocoin. It's possible that we are already the Nakamotans. In this case, the third law is applicable. Perhaps the development of blockchains is a great filter. Civilizations which don't discover Bitcoin never hyper-Bitcoinize and fail to develop the necessary energy economy to grow beyond their home planets. But if technological civilizations are more common, then we must resolve the Fermi paradox in a different way. We know that any solution is really a reflection in the mirror of universality, an interpretation of humanity's future based on what one believes about the present. With this understanding, and with many speculations about the laws of Bitcoin astronomy and alien blockchains behind us, we propose a new solution to the Fermi paradox, a member of the "They're Waiting for Our Signal" family. We haven't detected alien civilizations because we only just built Bitcoin. Advanced civilizations are out there, but because of the unicast structure of Interstellar Communications Network, they're just not messaging us, or not doing so very frequently. This is because advanced blockchain-using civilizations don't follow the water like NASA, they follow the hash rate. Just as we would be able to verify the scale of the Nakamoten civilization from their Xenocoin blockchain, our neighboring civilizations can verify the scale of human civilization from our own blockchain transmissions, or lack thereof. They may be waiting to message us until they can measure our position on the Kardashev scale through our proof of work. Our species discovered radio communication 125 years ago. Theoretically, civilizations within 125 light-years of our solar system may have detected signals from us. Practically, most of those signals are weak and unlikely to be detected. Strong signals from direct attempts at extraterrestrial communication, such as the Arecibo message or the Voyager Golden Record, might also have gone undetected as they were singular and not repeated transmissions. Even if some alien civilization had been listening at exactly the right time to detect them, the data they contain were probably uninterpretable. To a blockchain-using alien civilization, all our message would have signified is that we don't understand the implications of the third law. We probably don't have blockchains, we haven't experienced hyper-Bitcoinization, and we haven't reached type 1 on the Kardashev scale. We're simply not worth messaging. The Fermi paradox is the result of a relatively short gap, a few hundred years, in the history of human technology between developing telescopes, which make us more interested in nearby space, and developing Bitcoin, which makes us more interesting to nearby civilizations which occupy that space. The longer our civilization takes to hyper-Bitcoinize, the slower we climb the Kardashev scale, and the longer it takes us to join the market of worlds, a kind of have fun staying poor at the galactic scale. But we do have Bitcoin, and we are experiencing hyper-Bitcoinization. So, if we want to talk to ET, we should start by beaming the Bitcoin blockchain to as many nearby star systems as possible, as frequently as possible. Can that Blockstream satellite be pointed outward? Thank you. Many thanks to my colleagues at Unchained Capital for the many interesting conversations which led to speculations such as these. Particular thanks are due to Destry Saul, Joe Kelly, Phil Geiger, Martin Grigono, Buck Purley, and Walden Rains, all of whom helped with discussion and review. I must also thank Velvet Campbell by assuring her that this is the last article I intend to write on this topic. All right, that wraps up The Third Law, Bitcoin Astronomy, Part 3, by Dhruv Bansal. Let's say you're looking for a great place to buy Bitcoin. Maybe you want to set up a recurring savings plan, an automatic one, and you want it to automatically withdraw straight to your keys, so you don't have to do anything. Or maybe you're looking for, you know, just an epic Bitcoin-only conference, and you specifically would like it to be in November. Or you want to venture down the Bitcoin rabbit hole with endless amounts of the best curated content of the Bitcoin technology, its history, its philosophy, or you want concierge service. You want to set up your help setting up your hardware wallets. You want to know how to secure your keys, you want to connect your business accounts, your retirement accounts, your trust. You want access to the best team of Bitcoiners in the space to answer every question and guide you on your Bitcoin journey. Swan Bitcoin is the all of those. Swan Private is their concierge service. The Bitcoin Canon and the Swan Private newsletter and their Swan blog is the endless amount of incredible information in their knowledge base. SwanBitcoin.com/guy will get you set up with a recurring automatic savings plan and automatic withdrawal. You set it once and it just runs always. And the Pacific Bitcoin Conference in LA is where you need to be on November 10th and 11th. And you get 20% off your tickets with code GUYS, just for you guys. Check it all out right in the show notes. Details and links. Let's jump back in. As I always say, this is a super fun and ridiculous series. But it's amazing how many little hints of truth. There are real laws basically put into this. And, you know, outside of the idea of blockchains specifically, the concept of a blockchain, I think there are a couple of primitives, universals, that actually make the alien blockchain not a ridiculous idea. And I hinted at those a little bit in yesterday's Guy's Take, but the idea of money, the idea of transactions and ledgers and trade, because the idea of a civilization is the creation of, is a group of organisms becoming or behaving like an organism themselves, a group of thinking organisms that have the ability to abstract and cooperate and trade and basically build their own networks and structures from a collective of the organisms rather than collections of cells. You know, essentially the organism itself behaves like a cell, and there's this mental model, there's this mental structure by which they organize themselves, and it allows them to specialize. It allows them to trade and allocate resources across the civilization like they're allocating across the body of an organism that needs to feed every cell and sustain the civilization as a whole. And that is a necessary advancement to the scaling of civilization. Like, that's what led us from tribes to massive civilizations and societies that we have today. And it is what is going to enable, like, the nature of a single global currency, of a dominant global dollar, even considering the massive flaws and the obvious temporary nature of something that is so easily corrupted and can be used as a political tool because it has a massive counterparty risk. Obviously, the largest counterparty is still the most trustworthy, and therefore it becomes the dominant global currency. But that is exactly what enabled us to become a global society. It's what enabled, you know, you think about, as crazy as the last century has been, and as much quote-unquote war as there has been, we've also never had so much trade and interoperation and cooperation between countries. Like, the idea of peaceful, maintained waterways where unarmed merchant ships can just travel the entire world safely is completely and entirely unique in all of history. And we're also in an interesting place where entire countries have specialized to the point that whole countries, you know, just don't even grow their own food. They can't even sustain their own population except for the fact that they can trade with other countries that do, and they're able to provide the rare earth minerals or, you know, the gold, or they're able to provide, you know, one very specific resource or service or something in the global economy that makes it worthwhile for everyone who can grow food, that can produce oil, that can do all of these other things that their geographic location does not have access to. They can trade with these other countries and essentially be a part of the whole. They can be a part of a global ecosystem. All of that is to say, money is the crux of scaling civilization. It is the ability for institutions, for for countries, for people who do not trust each other and could have every reason to hate each other on every other dynamic, to be able to trustlessly provide and trade value with each other, and in doing so cooperate to a greater economic end than either could possibly produce or organize alone. So in that way, finding a means of consensus, maybe there's a better consensus mechanism than money. Arguably, Bitcoin is actually better than the idea of money that we have had in the past. It's a more explicit technology for the mechanism, for the concept of consensus, rather than just kind of like a haphazard good on the market that ended up kind of providing that goal or providing that role in the market or in the society. You could almost argue that, you know, it's almost like we've had fire for a long time, but we just used sticks. You know, we just rubbed sticks together really fast in order to make fire. And then one day we invented matches. We found, you know, fissile materials and realized that we could control and on demand create ignition. We found flint or something that allows us to start fires incredibly quickly and under explicit and direct control. And we're not using this other tool. It's not really for it, but, you know, just happened to fill the gap for, you know, some span of time. That's what all of our previous monetary goods kind of feel like, specifically because one of the things that people criticize Bitcoin for, you know, they say that what's Bitcoin's utility, right? What is it backed by? If you're not using it for money, you can't use it for anything else. It's like, well, that's because it's designed purely to be a money. It's actually a negative from its economic value and its ability to measure value across the economy and measure growth across the economy as a monetary good, if it actually has some very specific market that it's used for more than anything else. The reason money is such a powerful tool for measuring and allocating resources is because it is the most liquid good in every single part of the economy, and it's ubiquitous. You know, there's not like more desire to use money in order to, you know, build cars than it is to make shoes. It's the same. But what if there was like something about, there was a physical side of Bitcoin, and it just happens that you might want to use it in a shoe from time to time? Well, then it would actually disproportionately measure shoes against cars, because you're actually using the money itself not for being a money, but to put it in a shoe. You know, gold in that way actually distorts the market for jewelry. It distorts the market for electronics the more it's used for its utility purpose than it's being used for its monetary purpose. So in that way, you can actually say that in fact, there was actually a really good tweet that just reminds me of a tweet. Let me pause and find it really fast. Okay, found it. It's from Knuts von Holm. We've read a lot of stuff of his on the show. I've done all three of his audiobooks, Sovereignty through Mathematics, Independence Reimagined, and Everything Divided by 21 Million. And also, if you haven't seen them, I think I mentioned this in a show recently, is the videos that I and Ioni Appleberg do. Ioni does the animations, Knut does the writing, and I do the reading. But they're really good, and I highly recommend it. We've gotten a lot of great feedback from people who say they're really good, like, small, concise videos on hitting, like, a concrete, like, one specific idea around Bitcoin. But anyway, tangent. So Knut von Holm has this tweet, and he says, quote, Bitcoin is not money. It's not an asset, not a currency, not a store of value, not a quote crypto, and not digital gold. It's an agreement between people on a fixed set of rules, like chess, a way for us to interact with one another and ourselves in a more ethical manner, way better than money. And there's something to that. I think he's still just like having fun with the semantic side of things, because what ends up happening is that inevitably develops a money, a monetary good. There is still Bitcoin's the money. But Bitcoin, the system, is exactly what he said. It is an agreed upon set of rules with an economic game theory to keep those rules from changing. essentially a almost like a reverse prisoner's dilemma of ensuring that there is always an honest truth to lean on and that there is an unforgeable proof of the value attesting to the fact that it is in fact the honest truth. It's the honest history of the chain. But ultimately, that's what money is that agreement between people on a common good that is going to be used as the weight for everything else, the value weight for all other goods. Like I said, is that we've always just had subpar versions of that. We've had goods that we failed to recognize the role that they played and instead saw them for what they were on the market. We saw them less for their network and what they meant as a network and informational technology, and instead focused on what they were as like a physical good, when the physical good actually is largely irrelevant to the issue. The only reason that physical goods have previously been money is because before Bitcoin, physical goods were the only things that could actually sustainably have, that realistically had the characteristics that make a money. It simply wasn't possible in the digital world until Bitcoin. But ultimately, what it leads to is an independent set of rules. That is what gold established for people, an independent set of value rules, of monetary rules, that no country, no government could cheat. They tried to, they could cheat the notes, they could cheat the gold backing, there were all these different ways around it, but ultimately, the monetary base was still independent. It was neutral. So it acted as a set of rules, like the game of chess. Yes, maybe one championship, maybe the most popular championship in the world, can be cheated, and somebody can find a way to cheat the rules of chess and scam a whole bunch of people, but ultimately the rules of chess are still the rules of chess. And in that way, if we want to take that analogy, Bitcoin is essentially a game of chess that you can prove has not been cheated. But going back to the kind of sci-fi, the theory that Dhruv is talking about in this piece, in this whole series actually, is that it necessitates a civilization accomplishing this. Not necessarily Bitcoin, not necessarily a blockchain, but accomplishing a means to economically enforce economic rules. And I think in that context, and with that goal in mind for a technology, a networking technology, the civilization has to be able to be on the same economic network, or it is not a civilization. It is not a group of organisms working and trading together in order to achieve a cohesive society. They're warring civilizations, right? Like we think about it on Earth as, you know, past civilizations, is the civilization stopped at the edge of the power hierarchy, at the edge of the cultural network, right? And then civilizations would clash. They would go to war with each other. We weren't really one human civilization. And that's one of the kind of crazy things about the globalization of, you know, over the past 100 years or so, is that we're kind of becoming one. And we've had this sort of soft or vague peace where, you know, there was plenty to be angry about, and there's a lot of the political systems of the world were at odds, but, you know, we had a cold war, not a hot war, and trade remained active, even though in our current environment, that cohesion is breaking down because we're losing the assurances of all of our fiat money. Fiat, the modern fiat world, is essentially coming to its natural end, but and succumbing to the very vulnerabilities. It's a network that does not do its job. It's a network that has a critical, central vulnerability that is systemic, that will bring the entire thing down. And this is why, you know, a lot of people, like, I'm sure there's plenty of people who would normally think, especially normies, who would just immediately think, oh, well, that just means that the aliens have a great government. But I think it's completely ignoring any and all of decent human history and basic game theory to think that a centralized, violent, top-down government is actually a sustainable mechanism for accomplishing that sort of civilization. I think it's antithetical to the idea of cooperation and organization of a society or a species at that scale. I actually think the violent control and power is a consequence, we talk about this a lot on the show, but is the consequence of the technological limitation, and it's actually more of a band-aid. It's actually a fundamentally flawed one, flawed quote-unquote solution, but it's the closest thing that we've had to a technological solution. It's essentially a technological, like, it's like the least broken solution. You know, kind of like the tweet I gave just the other day is, you know, if you have like five sinking ships and one of them is sinking really slow and all the other four are sinking really, really fast, it appears as if the slow sinking ship is like doing really great, but it's still a sinking ship. That's kind of how I think of is like government as an organizational technology. It's like it's systemically broken, but in the face of no concrete solution to organizing tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people cohesively without them breaking apart into separate tribes and cultures and essentially warring with each other, and more importantly, being able to defend that cohesion, defend that cooperation against explicitly violent institutions and explicitly violent groups, well, then governments just are going to form due to the reward of violence at scale against vast numbers of people who are geographically locked to where they are. And I talk about this in an example in one of the previous episodes, is that, you know, if it cost the government $100 to make 110 in value to commit violence that gives them $110 in value back, when you defeat that system, that structure, you don't have to make it so that they don't get any money from the act of violence. You just have to make it not profitable. You just have to kill the margin on it. And I think fundamentally separating the bulk of our value by making our money a virtual thing, by replacing our money with a collective agreement that can't be cheated, when inflation is their number one tool for confiscating and essentially running the money, is an unbelievable power. It is a godlike power in a modern economy with hundreds of millions, billions of people working together to contribute all of these resources. The ability to just siphon off trillions and trillions of dollars of these resources quietly and in a hidden way, not directly from the people, is so sinister. It is having the counterfeit machine that lets you consume all of the resources and contribute nothing back to society. It's fraud. It is theft in a through the systemic means by which we cooperate, by cheating the mechanism by which we establish cooperation itself, which means that it's vulnerable, which means that it's broken. It's just a matter of how much time does it take, because of the amount of resources that we can produce, how much time does it take for that bug to actually collapse the system? Well, look at the financial system right now. Look at the global financial system. We're watching the outcome. And these things reset all the time. We see them collapse over and over and over again with the same failures and the same misallocations. And it's just in different places and at different scales, and they call them different names, and the derivatives are a different type of object. It's the same story over and over again until we actually fix it. And this is why I don't think it's possible for our civilization to be a cohesive civilization when we're talking about the globe, when we're talking about our planet. I don't think it's possible. But think about it in the context of the solar system or the galaxy or something. Oh, it's laughable. It's laughable to think that you can do this with our current systems of organization. And that's why I think a consensus protocol, a form of agreement that forces economic cooperation by diminishing or removing the ability for violence to give the return in the system. Violence at scale against Bitcoin does not work within Bitcoin. And fundamentally, proof of work is what runs that protection, what runs that economic game theory. And it's also fascinating to think that proof of work is universal across species. We see it across species in the world today, like just on our planet. Proof of work is, in a sense, a form of a common language or a social, it's a biological signal. So in a fascinating way, wouldn't proof of work also be, wouldn't it be cross species in a galactic environment as well, in intelligent species? And what would an intelligent species proof of work look like? If the ultimate language, you know, whether you're, you know, in ancient China or in, you know, modern, you know, the scientific renaissance or whatever, when you develop math, whether you show the same symbols or whatever, the mathematical relationships of the universe can be discovered independently of each other without communication, and you come to the same conclusions. You come to the same relationships. They're fundamental relationships of the universe. The universe speaks mathematics. If there is an alien civilization, and we're right about any of our fundamental patterns and fundamental math of how we, of gravity, of the speed of light, they are going to reach the same conclusions. They are going to know E equals MC squared as well, unless they've disproven it or they found something more fundamental that is a building block that kind of makes it obsolete. But what else would an intelligent species use to communicate or to prove the, or to use as a biological signal, a civilizational signal of the advancement of a species than math? Than proof of work via an economic and mathematical system. And does that mean blockchain? Does that mean, you know, an intergalactic blockchain? Like that specific piece of it, you know, it's super fun to think about, but there really is. It really is. There's something very fundamental. Like as silly as this sounds, as silly as the idea of talking about alien blockchains can seem, there's a note of really fascinating fundamental truths to it that's just kind of, you gotta admit, it's like just like a little bit possible. Or maybe I'm just a remarkable nerd. Probably, maybe both. I feel like both is a very reasonable conclusion. Anyway, we will close this out. I need to go feed Rad and get him to sleep. Oh, I'm sorry, Bogar. Thank you guys. Thank you guys so much for listening. I actually didn't get through all my notes here. There's a lot of quotes from this one that are great. Oh man, there's one last little thing I want to say. So one of the quotes down here at the end says, "This is because advanced blockchain using civilizations don't follow the water like NASA. They follow the hash rate." So just to tack on to the end here, I just thought that was fascinating because one of the things that we've talked about before on this show, but how, you know, different sources of water is essentially what led to the spreading of our species across the planet. And you notice where populations existed and populations popped up and sustained themselves are around various sources, waterways, ports, you know, connections to the ocean, like all of this stuff. Water has always been what judged where we could set up shop, so to speak, as a species. But that began to change with the Industrial Revolution. And then suddenly out in the Midwest, you get like coal mines, you get like oil fields and these things, which have these little spots, these little settlements that can start to build and start to create a foundation for things. And the theory, is Bitcoin is a pioneer species. It's a Brandon Quittam's piece that really hits this, is that we are actually Bitcoin and mining allows us to harness energy that is separate from, that is way out from society, that is in undesirable environments, that will actually enable us, if we can profitably create or profitably use those energy sources and harness energy in completely inhospitable environments that we don't necessarily need to follow the water anymore, because we can create our own water. We can solve the water situation when we get there by following the energy, by chasing the hash rate profitability, by finding stranded energy sources. And I thought that was really fascinating. So I'll just without going through that whole discussion again, I'll drop the link to Bitcoin is a Pioneer Species by Brandon Quittam. Highly recommended. With that, though, thank you guys so much. Thank you to our sponsors, to CoinKite, to Swan Bitcoin, and to the Fold Card for making this show possible. Thank you to the Audionauts. I love you guys. Awesome crew, and I really appreciate everybody supporting the show. And with that, I will be back tomorrow with another episode. And until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. Perhaps we have forgotten that we are still pioneers, that we have barely begun, that our greatest accomplishments cannot be behind us, because our destiny lies above us. Interstellar.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.